Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Hey, welcome back to the Pod Crashed. This week, we're telling the story of Pan Am Flight 73. Thanks for listening.
We got to the place we were going.
And here we are. We've arrived. Mm-hmm. Mariah, so Casey. Much, like, both of our lives have been so crazy, and we haven't gotten to talk as often, and so yeah. It's like one of those things I can't believe I still haven't told you. Did you know that we have an aviation podcast? It seems
I thought
implausible.
You were
going to
say, did you know I have a cat?
Oh, I wish. No, I'm so sad okay. We don't. No, even more implausible. See, me having a cat, believable. It's right. Shocking that I don't have one yet.
It is.
The idea that we have an aviation podcast, not plausible. I don't believe it.
No, and yet, but we do. We're here.
We do. It turns out we do. Amazing.
And you all keep coming back, so thank you.
Oh, we love you guys so much. Yeah. We love you so much. So, happy Thanksgiving.
Yes, happy Thanksgiving.
Yes.
I'm doing so much cooking.
Oh my gosh, I bet you are. For you and it's Ty, okay, who are you doing for Thanksgiving?
Yeah, we're going to my in-laws, so that'll be nice.
Oh,
I'm excited.
Nice.
To see everybody. Yeah, yeah, it'll be good. What are you guys doing?
We're doing the Brian's parents and then my parents. So the fam.
Awesome.
Yes.
Good.
We're back in.
That'll be so nice. Yeah. You're like back and able to go home afterwards. And
I have done no cooking. I'm going to after this. So it's almost 9 p.m. right now. Yeah. And you and I have both been working all day. And after you and I get off the phone, I'm going to go and buy vegan whipped topping. And that will be my contribution. Brian cooked something, but I will buy vegan whipped topping, and it will be much appreciated. So, thank you all.
It'll be good.
So today we are doing Pan Am Flight 73. So Pan Am, Lux, like the, you know, height of like the golden age of flying. We're a little maybe past the golden age because we're in 1986.
Right.
We're going to September 5th, 1986. Great. Love it. Gorgeous.
Yeah.
The 80s.
Close to Labor Day.
Infinite smoking on infinite planes. Mm-hmm. And especially no doubt on this plane because we are flying a 747. The Lux.
Awesome.
The glory, the beauty of a 747. The 747 has a name, which we love. The name of the plane is Clipper Empress of the Seas. So,
oh, perfect.
Beautiful.
So good.
Yeah. And we're flying from Mumbai, which is called Bombay at this point, Mumbai to Karachi, Pakistan, to Frankfurt, West Germany at this time, how the world changes, to JFK, baby, because all planes make it to JFK. All planes make it to JFK at some point.
At some point in their life.
You're not a plane if you haven't been to JFK. It simply isn't done.
It's where all planes are born, actually.
Yeah, it is. It's like, it's where the plane storks roosts.
Exactly.
Oh boy, it's too late. Our brains. It's fine. It's a 747. Lots of legs. Pan Am. This route is actually like a little bit unique because Pan Am, American company, most of their flight crews are American. But for this route, they actually made a decision to hire all Indian cabin crew. So all of the flight attendants are Indian. And that was kind of like a big thing and like something crazy, like 40,000 people applied for like 90 positions or something.
Whoa.
So yeah. So Pan Am is kind of like investing in this route. It's cool.
Yeah.
Right.
I would hate to be the employer though, reviewing those resumes.
No, Without no algorithm, no email, no,
right?
Paper,
no computer, just paper resumes.
Just paper resumes. Good Lord. So, the pilots are American. We got Captain Bill. Bill has been a captain, not just a pilot, but a captain for Pan Am since 1954, baby.
Whoa.
Bill has flown everywhere. He has seen everything. Like Bill, he was a Korean War vet. So everyone forgets about the Korean War, and yet sure did happen. So Korean War vet. And we've got the flight first officer, Conaway, which is a very cool name. That's like a cool first name, right? Conaway. Mm-hmm. He's been a pilot with Pan Am since 55. So also company
man. A
lot
of experience in the cockpit today.
Also a Korean War vet. So like just what experience? And then the flight engineer is John. John, not a Korean War vet, but no doubt like an experienced and wonderful flight engineer. So
yeah.
And then we've got 19 Indian flight attendants. So cool. We're getting ready for this like big old long flight all around. We're flying from Mumbai to Karachi. So for anybody that doesn't know, there's going to be a sousant of unavoidable politics in this. And I'm just going to ask all of you for grace. And I'm not going to go into it in too much detail, but it's just here. It's just present. So for those of you who might not know, Pakistan and India, maybe historically, some beef. And
that's a great way to say it.
Yeah, some beef. I don't mean that as a, I'm not trying to make any, whatever. What can we do, guys?
No.
Benefit of the doubt. So
yes.
And going back to obviously like the history of colonization, and then when England was like, well, fine, be free if you want to, then they were like, but we're gonna split the country up into multiple countries so you guys can fight it out. And here we are. So this flight, Mumbai to Karachi, important route, right, for that reason. And it's such a long flight. So the Mumbai to Karachi part is by far the shortest part of this flight. And we've got it under our belt. So we've flown from Mumbai to Karachi. We're good. They arrived in Karachi, Pakistan at 4:30 a.m. So it's just sun's not up yet. It's September, so it's not time for the sun to rise quite yet. But it's like that early, like pre-dawn, super... just that, I don't know, I can't imagine being at work, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you were the flight attendants or the pilots, right? Like you're at work and you're just like one leg down at 4:30 in the morning. So they've stopped, they're out on the tarmac. The plane is kind of parked out on the tarmac. So they've got to bus passengers back and forth to the plane. So the passengers who are getting off, they're busing them back to the airport. Passengers who are getting on, they're being bused from the airport. And they've got the air stairs down from the plane to the tarmac. So swapping people out, this like very new, very young Indian flight crew, like the flight attendants are, you know, all of that like luxe, gracious, inviting, smiling, you know, care that they get. And everybody's smoking. So they're swapping out the passengers 4:30 in the morning. And a Pakistani airport security van drives across the tarmac toward the plane, which, okay, not that unusual, right?
Mm-hmm.
And four men hop out of that vehicle and start shooting.
Oh, no.
And as they start to shoot, they fire into the air, but also fire randomly like across the tarmac, and immediately actually hit two ramp guys who are working on a different plane across the tarmac. And they charge up the stairs, and the flight attendants try to shut the door. The doors can technically be shut from the inside, but these doors are meant to be closed from the outside. So they're like trying to shut the door, and they like push their way in and shove the door open and come in, and suddenly there's four hijackers on the plane. While they're pushing their way on, Nijra is one of the flight attendants, and she's in the back kind of, and so she grabs the phone and calls the pilots who are upstairs in the cockpit and gives them the code word for hijacking. And the pilots do not need to be told twice. They can hear the guns firing, and they hop, like shimmy, they pop. There's hatches in the roof of the cockpit, and they pop those hatches out. Yeah, emergency exits. So they pop those out, and there's basically a bat rope. I don't know another way to explain it, that they grab onto, and it slides them down to the ground. And they,
like a Batman rope?
Like Batman, exactly. Yeah. They get the word, they hear the guns, they pop right out the attic and down and then onto the tarmac and run.
Ugh.
The hijackers grab Shireen and Sunshine, two of the other flight attendants, grab them, put the gun to their heads. They bring us to the cockpit. So they bring them up the stairs. They don't know that Nijra's told them about, told the pilots yet. They go up the stairs. They get to the cockpit. They open it up. Empty. No pilots. Sunshine can see. She knows exactly what's happened. She knows that they've popped out of the roof and gone down, but she doesn't know when. She doesn't know if they've just left and they're on the tarmac and could be shot or what. So she just doesn't say anything and watches the hijackers as they kind of look around, but they don't even notice the hatch in the roof because they're just not familiar with the planes. So they don't know what's happened. They're kind of confused. They don't know if the pilots are hiding. They don't know if the pilots hadn't boarded yet or what's happening. But this is a problem for the hijackers, because the hijackers' goal, their plan, what they're trying to do here is fly this plane full of people to Cyprus. The hijackers are members of the ANO. It's a group that no longer exists that formed essentially in opposition to American and Israeli influence in the Middle East. I'm gonna leave it alone at that. So they their goal was to fly to Cyprus and negotiate for the release of some of their fellow members of this group who are being held captive in Cyprus. So that was their goal. No pilots. Okay. So problem number one for the hijackers, they need pilots. So everybody on the plane, so there's still two hijackers downstairs with all the passengers, and they start to push everybody into the center of the plane. So all the passengers that were seated in first class upstairs on the same level as the pilots, they bring them all downstairs and they kind of shove all of the passengers into the middle of the plane where there's not nearly enough seats, because there are 390 people.
No.
390 people.
Already on the plane.
Already on the plane. So are 379, there's 360 passengers plus the crew. So they shove very nearly 400 people into the middle of the plane. And so people are, on the floor, wherever they can just squish in. The engines are off, and the power that's being used right now, the air conditioning that's on, the lights that are on, because the sun hasn't come up yet, is just the auxiliary power unit. So shove into the middle of the plane, and immediately the hijacker's plan has gone off the rails right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Which they're mad about. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and granted, my knowledge is based 100% on the Titanic. However, it's the whole thing with the captain is supposed to go down with the ship. And then in exactly when she opens up the cockpit, they weren't there. I was like, ooh, good thing they got
no
out.
Exactly, right, exactly. So in a hijacking, part of Pan Am's training, and I think part of any hijacking training that would be normal in any situation similar is to immobilize the plane, and not having pilots on the plane is an excellent way to immobilize the plane. So like the flight crews are relieved that the pilots are not on the plane, because that means that this plane is not taking off. The flight attendants know that they're not going to send the pilots back, and they're not going to send different pilots. They know that. The hijackers think, we have 400 people here who we're going to just kill if we want to, so
right,
we bet we can get them to send us some pilots so we can go to Cyprus. So they really don't know anything about planes, though. So they don't know how to use the radio. They go to the door, open the door again, and start to just yell from up 30 feet in the air where the door is of a 747. They just open the door and like yell out to the negotiators who are out there. They're just like yelling their demands. Send us a pilot. Send us a pilot. Send us pilots so we can fly. Like, we're going, we're getting out of here. And so they're just literally just yelling back and forth, demanding pilots so that they can fly.
Yeah.
Negotiators, we're 8 minutes into this. We're very early days. So the people who are out there are like the, you know, highest available person, right? Like, yeah, high security. Other people are like rushing on their way there. But in the immediate, it's just they're yelling to people who are just not prepared for the situation quite yet, right? But they are gathering up people who hopefully are going to be able to do something. They are yelling their demands. The people who are down there at this like immediate moment are not skilled hostage negotiators, right? These,
right,
are people who are just like, well, no, no, we're not going to send you pilots, so sorry, no. And they go in the back and kind of go up and down the aisles, or like push their way through people, because aisles are full of people because they've crammed everybody into the center. Like, and again, just that thing, 400 people, like old people, babies, unaccompanied minors, like families, people traveling by themselves. And they see Rajesh. Now, Rajesh is a 29-year-old man, born in Kenya, Indian ethnically, just became an American citizen that year. He has just become an American citizen, and he has come to visit his family. He's on his way back home, and he has his U.S. passport visible. And they grab Rajesh and they drag him to the front and have him kneel down in the doorway of the plane. Safirini is the name of the lead hijacker. And Safirini yells down to them, says like, bring us pilots right now, or we're going to start killing people every 15 minutes. And he yells down, and again, the negotiators are like, there's people trying to get to the scene, but like the people down there are like not excellent at handling this situation. And the best hostage negotiator in the world is still getting their bearings in this moment, right? And
exactly,
the communication is incredibly strained because nobody can get that close to the plane because they'll get shot, right? They're afraid, like, it is not safe to have people up close. So they're just shouting back and forth. And Safirini has Rajesh kneeling in the doorway, and they're yelling back and forth, and he's getting angrier and angrier, and the negotiators are like, whatever they're saying, he doesn't like. And just a couple minutes after he said, we want pilots in 15 minutes, he just pops and shoots Rajesh in the head.
Jeez.
Pushes him off the plane, and Rajesh falls down to the ground. And to their immense, like just incredible bravery, some people who are watching, some of the like just regular people who are not passengers, but the regular staff at the airport who are watching this, actually run across the tarmac and get Rajesh and like bring him back so that he can get medical attention, which is incredibly, incredibly dangerous. I cannot imagine what just amazing bravery these two people do. Run and grab Rajesh, but he's gone. He's gone. So immediately, minutes into this thing, it's not yet 5 o'clock in the morning, and they've already shot one young man without even waiting as long as the very short period of time they said they would wait. And there's no pilots on the plane. So they're right off the bat, they're stuck. They're in this stalemate. And they've already killed, in fact, 3 people because they killed 2 Kuwait Airline employees right off the bat. So immediately, not even a half hour into this thing, they're stuck. They're at like a complete stalemate with the negotiators because they want pilots and they're not going to send them pilots. And the hijackers have already shown that they're just going to kill people.
Yeah.
So in this unbelievably, like, terrifying, stuck position, Nirja, the woman who had called the pilots and warned them, this young 22-year-old flight attendant, is now the highest ranking person on the plane. She's the lead flight attendant. She's the purser. There's no pilots on board. Nirja realizes, like, oh, I'm literally the ranking person on this aircraft, and I have 400 people who are terrified and crushed into the center of this plane. We're going to talk about Nirja for a second here. Okay, Nirja's 22 years old. And Nirja
is beautiful.
No. She's a very, very, very beautiful young woman. And she had started doing like modeling. She had like gone to good school. She's just like a beautiful, lovely, wonderful person. And she is, in fact, like a working professional model.
Yeah.
She had gotten married. Her parents had arranged a marriage for her, and she had gone to live with her husband, and her husband was a piece of shit. Her husband was an abusive fucking asshole. He starved her. He like constantly just berated her. He like yelled at her. He wouldn't let her eat. He was told her, like, you can't do any modeling anymore. Like, you can't even cook. You don't clean. You don't do anything. Like, said that his wrote letters incessantly to her father saying that her dowry had been like nothing and she's like worthless and you've just like stuck me with this woman and like all of this. He's like a horrible, abusive monster.
And like, what the fuck are you doing, bro? Like, relax.
Right. She's 19 at the time. She's this beautiful young woman, and you just treat her so badly. So Nirja had gone back to visit her parents, and when her parents saw her, she'd lost. So she was already a model. So she was a slender young woman to begin with. She'd lost 5 kilos, so 12 pounds. No. She lost in this like a couple month period because he's starving her. And Nirja's parents love her. She's their only daughter. And they were just like, oh, no, fuck this guy. And there's a letter that you can read that her father sent to her soon to be ex-husband that was just like, we would never in a million years send our daughter back to like a ghoul like you little dweeby worm. Fuck you. Never contact us again. You are no longer married. Like, keep the dowry, asshole. Like, so Nirja is like this, and she had proceeded to like, you know, just go back into like the loving arms of her wonderful family. And she had like bounced back from that, and she was like continued to do modeling and was in fact very successful at that. And then she went for this job for Pan Am, like their first ever Indian flight attendant crew, got the job, and not only got the job, but right off the bat got hired to be the purser, like the lead flight attendant. So she's just, this is like a remarkable young woman. And
it's a lot of life.
A lot of life
for 22
years old. 22. She's going to turn 23 in 2 days. It's September 5th. Her birthday is September 7th. She's 2 days shy of 23, and she's in charge. She is the highest ranking person on this plane.
You got it.
Thanks to her own bravery, right? Because she's the reason the pilots are off the plane. So Nirja watches them murder this young man and throw his body off the plane. And she says, like, okay, hey, guys, so we got to start, like, passing out water and getting, you know, food. We got to, like, take care of these people. Like, look at them. What are we doing? And so she, like, gently starts to, like gather her colleagues so they can start to, like, help the passengers, like, because she, it's a stalemate, right? So she's trying to help people. And Safarini is like, what are you doing? You stop. You can't. And she says, like, you got a job to do. I got a job to do. Which, like, whoo, girl. Like, and what are you going to say to that? Like, Safarini was like, okay,
It's fight or flight. It's fight or flight right now.
Right. Like, you got a job.
Flight is not an option.
No. Right. We're not flying. Exactly. We're on the ground. And these people are hungry. Like, this, we need something. So, but Nirja, while she's like passing out food and things like that, she goes and takes her manual, so her own manual, and rips out the page that explains how to open the doors.
Oh my God.
And puts it into a magazine. And then while she's handing out the food, she goes over to the passenger who's sitting at the R4 door. So that means, if you imagine R and L just stand for right and left, and then the numbers, the ones, the lowest number, so number one, is the one that's closest to the nose of the plane, closest to the cockpit. And four and five are like the last ones closest to the tail. So she goes to the passenger who's at R4, meeting the passenger who's going to be close to like the center of the plane, and hands him the magazine with the page ripped out in it, and says, like, be sure to read that. Like, hi,
please.
Like,
yeah,
you know, welcome to Pan Am. Sorry, things aren't going the way we wanted it to. Here's a magazine. Like, be sure to read it carefully. Like, let me know if you need anything else. So she's going around and she's trying to do anything that she can. And the other flight attendants are on board too. They know that there's no pilots on this plane. It's just them. It's just them. The negotiators are yelling back and forth, can barely hear each other. They're the ones who are on board this plane. They're the ones whose lives are in danger, but they're also the only people who are going to be able to do anything. Mm. This stalemate just drags on. It's dragging on and on and on. And the hijackers like want to like make this happen, right? Like they want to get into the air, and the longer they're just sitting on the tarmac, the more they feel like we're not going anywhere. So they say, like, okay, so we just saw Rajesh's passport, and that's how we knew he was American. His passport was just out, and that's how we know. So let's just gather all of the passenger passports. We'll be able to separate all the Americans. The Americans will be functionally just of value in a negotiation, right?
Yeah.
So they're talking about that, and the flight attendants can hear them talking about this, right? They're not being subtle, or I don't know if they don't realize that the flight attendants have languages in common with them. I don't know why they're just discussing their plan so openly, but all the flight attendants are hearing this, and then they turn around and tell the flight attendants, go around and collect all the passports. So they take garbage bags, and Nirja directs this process where, like, do not have American passports in this bag. Like, they just said that their goal is, like, they already killed Rajesh. Like, they're gonna kill the Americans if we bring them up here. So like, don't take them. So the flight attendants are going around and like the passengers are handing over their passports, and you know, different flight attendants are handling it different ways. So some of them, if like an American family like hands their passports, they're just like shaking their head, just like, nah, like you actually don't have a passport, hide that. Mm-hmm. Or they're like taking them and then like stuffing them under the seats. Or when they gather all the passports up, Nirja goes through and like grabs the couple of U.S. passports that did make it their way in and just dumps them into the garbage, which again, it's a plane. Like, it's right. Not like there's infinity places to hide. You're having to do all of this in a way that puts you in like very real danger.
Yeah.
So she
Flight attendants.
God. Young flight attendants.
Yeah.
Like early 20s flight attendants. So they go sneaky. Up. She's being so sneaky. So sneaky and so brave. All of them are. And so they bring this like garbage bag full of, as it turns out, like 350 passports, because there were 43 Americans still on board the plane. So 43 passports. It's not like six. It's a lot. Right. It's dozens of passports that they're having to surreptitiously hide or not accept or whatever, throw out. So they bring up this like big sack of 350 passports, hand them over, and the hijackers go through the bag and don't find any American passports, which again, I'm just going to be honest, these are not the best hijackers in the world. They're they're not. So they go through and they're just like, weird. I really would have thought there'd be some U.S. passports instead of, which is again, great for the flight attendants that they didn't realize or didn't push it. I don't know how long the hijackers have been awake. I don't know, whatever. Yeah. So they're just like, weird. Who would have thought? And then they just grab a British passport and they're like, close enough. And I'm just going to say there were like 30 Canadians on board. And I'm like, I mean, if you're going for close enough to American, but the British guys are the ones, maybe we'll leave it alone, but we'll leave it alone. So they grab the British passport out and they turn to Nirja and say like, call this guy up. And I can't imagine how this would feel, right? To like be the one who has to like call someone up when you've just seen them kill somebody.
Yeah.
So she calls up Mike. Mike is a young British man who was on vacation in Pakistan and now he's headed back home. He's going to connect in Frankfurt and he hears his name. And he walks up and Safarini asked him, like, are you a soldier? Do you have a gun or anything like that? And Mike is just like, no, like, I don't have any, no. And he says, like, okay, like, kneel down in the doorway of the plane. So exactly the same place. I mean, there's, guys, I'm not trying to be horribly graphic, but, like, Rajesh was just shot there.
Yeah.
Maybe an hour prior. Like, there's blood. Like, he has to kneel down where they've just seen him kill somebody. And so Mike kneels down in the doorway. And they're yelling back and forth to the negotiators, and he tells them, we're going to kill passengers every 15 minutes if we don't get pilots. And the negotiators are seeing this, so this would be the fourth person for them to kill. And the negotiators see this, and the leader, the head of Pan Am India, or Pan Am Asia, maybe, but whoever it is, the leader of this area, right, the highest ranking Pan Am employee is present now, and he's got basically one card to play. And so he takes, they have a megaphone, and he yells like, hey, there's a Pan Am employee on board who knows how to use the radio. We'll tell you his name, and that way he can help you communicate on the radio. That way we can speak more easily, which is not, it's basically their only card, right? And it's not a direct response to, we're going to kill a passenger every 15 minutes. But they hear that and they're like, okay, yeah, what's his name? And I don't know if he heard his name or when he heard his name, but this like young mechanic, Pan Am mechanic, sitting in the back, not an American citizen, not in uniform, no reason for anybody to pick him out. His name is Mahirji, and they go and grab Mahirji. While they're finding him, he's 28, Safarini, so they're going to find Mahirji. Safarini is there with Mike, gun pointed to his head. Mike is kneeling in this doorway with blood from Rajesh and looking down the 30 feet to the ground. And Safarini is like, hey, Mike, do you want any water? And Mike is like, yeah, I want some water. And he says, like, okay, goes and gets him a cup of water. And Safarini comes back and is just like, are you married? And Mike is like, no. And again, this like cognitive dissonance, the person has a like gun to your head and is just like chit-chatting with you and bringing you water. And Safarini is like, I hate all this violence, but, you know, they've like ruined my country. And again, Mike, what's Mike supposed to say to that? Like,
right.
Just, you know what I mean? It's, they find Mahirji, they bring him up, and they kind of look at Mike and they kick Mike and tell him, like, get back with the rest of the passengers. Ooh. So they just kind of, they've got a different, they're kind of like following a different track now. So Mike goes from, you know, kneeling in blood to with a gun to his head to just getting like basically a kick and sent back to the rest of the passengers. So again, this is like this mind numbing, terrifying stalemate. So they take Mahirji and they grab two flight attendants, Sunshine, God bless her, that's her real God-given name, Sunshine, yes. And Shireen. Sunshine, Shireen, and Mahirji, they grab them, they grab the women by their hair, and they put the guns to their heads, and they like drag them up to the cockpit, which again is empty. There's not anybody even on the second floor. They go up to the cockpit, and they take two of the hijackers, Safarini and another one, like hold each of the flight attendants, grab them by their hair, and basically use them as like human shields so they can walk up to the windows and look out. And they're like ordering the flight attendants to tell them what they see and say, like, do you see anything like this? Do you see anything like that? Do you see any like military aircraft? Do you see anything? And they don't. They tell them what they see. And they have Mahirji sit down and they start to communicate using the radio. And it's another stalemate. So now they're communicating on the radio.
Yeah.
But nothing has changed. They're not, they want pilots so they can fly away. They're not going to give them pilots. So they're talking back and forth on the radio. And it's just another stalemate. Hours just drag on and on and on. Jeez. And on and on. And again, there's hundreds of people on this plane. Downstairs, there's two hijackers, nearly 400 passengers, and 17 of the flight attendants. And the flight attendants, Nirja and the rest, are trying to like keep the passengers calm. There are a ton of unaccompanied minors on this plane, so literally children traveling by themselves. There's like babies, there's old folks, there's people like you and I'm neither a child nor an old person. I would have a hard time in this situation, right? Like, yeah. It's just, and they're like doing everything they can to like tend to the passengers who are going through this like heinous experience while they themselves are also going through it. In the cockpit, they're going back and forth on the radio, but again, nothing's happening, right? And they're, you know, the Pan Am and the like Pakistani government aren't overtly saying like there's a 0% chance we are going to give you pilots. But the hijackers know that no pilots have materialized as hours and hours drag on. And in that time, like, the hijackers, you know, Sunshine and Shireen are also beautiful women, right? Like, they're beautiful, like, lovely people.
And young.
And so these, like, hijackers, while they, again, have guns pointed to them, sitting in this cockpit for hours, are just, like, chit-chatting with them, right? Like, they shift into that gear and they're just, like, chit-chatting, trying to flirt with them. Safarini, like, invites Sunshine to go to Cyprus with him, which is, again, like, you've imprisoned us and your intent is to go to Cyprus, so, like, inviting her, like, oh my gosh, you should come to Cyprus with me. Like, Sunshine doesn't know how to swim, and he says, like, oh, in Cyprus I can teach you how to swim. Like, they're having this, like he's, they're, god, it's so just your mind, right? Like, how could your mind endure this? And there's the fire axe in the cockpit, right, for, you know, horrible situations. And at some point, like, Sunshine is just, like, kind of, you know, looking at that axe.
Yeah.
And Safarini catches her and, like, shifts gears and is just like, don't even think about it. And, like, shifts, you know, out of that, like, flirty conversation into, like, I have every intent. My intent is to kill you. Right. Like, that. And I need you. Hours and hours on and on. And morning turns to afternoon, turns to evening. The sun comes up and the sun goes down. Oh, and there is just nothing. 17 hours. The flight attendants are just doing their best to, like, keep everybody sane as much as possible, to just make sure that the unaccompanied minors are okay. And up in the cockpit for hours and hours, Sunshine and Shireen are basically trying to mollify these, you know, men who are here to kill them. And like, Mahirji is just going back and forth, like, running a radio, which hours and hours, and now that it's nighttime, the auxiliary power unit doesn't last forever. And so, as now it's dark, they can see that, like, the lights are dimming, the AC is slowing down, the electricity is literally running out on the plane. And the hijackers, again, don't seem to know anything about aircraft, and they didn't expect that to happen. And the flight attendants tell them, well, the batteries don't last forever.
Right.
And that starts to shift things. So they've spent 17 hours. They got onto this plane and they thought they were going to be in the air within a few minutes. And instead, they're still on the ground. No pilots. Doesn't look like pilots are coming. Exhausted. All of the people have spread out a little bit, but as the lights are dimming, as the mood is shifting, the Safarini tells, like, Mahirji, like, right now, now or never, we getting pilots or no? And the answer is no, right? The answer is no. There's not going to be pilots coming to this plane. Downstairs, the two hijackers who have been, like, with the passengers this whole time, herd all of the people into the middle of the plane. So they go and, like, people are sleeping in the aisles. People have maybe not relaxed a little bit, but it's 17 hours, right? You're going to spread out a little bit. You're going to find room. You're going to put your baby to lay down. You're going to do these different things. The lights are dimming. It's pitch black outside, and they push everybody back into the middle of the plane. And then the lights go out. The electricity cuts off. Air conditioning dies. The plane is all closed up. Every door is closed. And there's the emergency lights that run, you know, down the aisle and illuminate the doors. But Mahirji says, he's a mechanic, and he tells them, like, these lights only last about 10, maybe 15 minutes. These lights are meant to help people evacuate, and then
yeah,
they're done. Downstairs, in the near total darkness, with 370 people stuffed into the middle of this plane, the two hijackers have walked up to the front of the plane. So they're both at the front of the plane between the L1 and R1 doors, meaning like all the way forward, the forwardmost doors. They're in that little aisle between. And one of them is wearing a bomb belt. Wow. That he's been wearing this whole time. And the other one prays and then turns around and shoots the belt on his comrade. But it's dark. And so instead of hitting like the detonator, he just explodes one of the charges. That snaps, right? It just snaps everybody. It snaps everything. I can't imagine. I think it would just feel
so
like
loud.
It would be so loud,
so
and it would
loud.
Just feel
so close. Yeah,
the 17 hours of tension, 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 and then bam! Upstairs, Soferini and the other hijacker who are upstairs hear the bomb go off, hear the bullet. It's dark. Okay, it's time. They like shout and just start to shoot in the cockpit. It's just the two of them and three employees. They start to shoot in the cockpit, just across everybody, and then run downstairs. And the hijackers just aim into that crowd of people and start to just fire. It's pitch black, and in the darkness, three doors are opened. So one door, Nirja opens the door that's closest to her, that's over the right wing of the plane. When she opens it, the slide doesn't deploy. So there's no slide, and 747s are way off the ground, but it is over the wing. So there's like a little bit you can hop down onto the wing, and then you can't see in the darkness. You can't see the ground from the wing. So she could have run out, right? She knows how far the wing is from the ground. She works on this plane, but she doesn't. She opens the door and she starts to rush people out in the like black. You're in a black hole, literally, with hundreds of people, and you're being shot at. So Nirja opened the R3 across the thing. So the passengers that are at Nirja's door are hopping out onto the wing and then jumping off and falling 20 feet. And just, you know, jeez. I mean, that a 20 foot fall, yeah. That's a lot. That actually is rough. So as she's like sending people out, obviously not everybody, it's just panic. It's pandemonium, yeah. Right? It's insane. Across the way, upstairs, Sunshine and Shireen like hit the ground when they started firing in the cockpit. And then the hijackers had run out of the cockpit so quickly in order to go kill more people downstairs. Shireen and Sunshine are on the ground looking at each other, and they haven't been shot. They're fine. And they look, and Mahirji is dead. They shot him. And so they run downstairs they could have stayed up there, but they run downstairs into the firing, into the place where all of these hundreds of people are like crushing as they try not to get shot. They open the L3 door, so the one directly across from the one that Nirja opened, which again, it's not ideal to be only opening doors in this narrow spot, but that's where all of the passengers are. So they open that door over the other wing, and that slide doesn't deploy either. And so they're sending people out onto the wing, and some people are just going for it. Some people are running away from gunfire in a crush of just human beings, and they just run out, jump off, break a bone, whatever. Like, they just go. they hear that across the way behind the wing on the left side, on the right side, behind the wing on the right side, behind the door Nirja opened, the passenger that Nirja gave the instructions to opened his door, and that door, the slide did deploy. So Sunshine and Shireen are sending people out who are jumping, and they start to try to reroute people. Sunshine and Shireen are trying to reroute people from the door that they themselves opened over to the other door so they can just slide down, go. So they're running through trying to get, again, hundreds of people off. And while this is happening, not only are the hijackers shooting at them, but they brought grenades, and in the darkness, they're pulling grenades and throwing them into this crowd. Again, not the world's best hijackers. They're not pulling the pins out all the way, so they're either not going off, or when they go off, most of them are just going off in like a really muted way. It's like not a complete detonation. Whatever, it's still loud and terrifying, and all you can see in the darkness is like the light of the bullets going through the air. So they're crushing people, like trying to get people out, go. Sunshine, Shireen, Dilip, Mavdi, there's so many people, we're not going to be able to even name all of them, but as the flight attendants are trying to grab all of the passengers, trying to rush them out, the hijackers literally run out of bullets. They run out of bullets.
Yeah.
Sunshine and Shireen are on the wing, and they can hear that the firing has stopped. And they don't know they've run out of bullets. They just know that for 1 second, the firing has stopped, and they've just helped hundreds of people just pour out of this plane. And they go back in. They go back into this plane. When they go back in, they can see Nirja, and she's been shot. She's bleeding heavily. She had run back to get two little children, unaccompanied minors, that she'd been caring for hours, and she'd run back to get them, and the hijackers saw her running for them and shot in their direction, and she had like covered them with her body. She's lying there bleeding and alive, and Sunshine screams out the door to a male flight attendant who's out there waiting on the wing, screams for him to come help, and so he comes back in, and the two of them drag her to the slide and down the slide with her. When they get down, they run with her.
God.
Away from the plane to an ambulance. And the ambulance literally, like, across the tarmac, the ambulance literally just takes her and, like, carries her. Like, the driver takes her, like, into the back of the ambulance. No stretcher, no nothing, and just rushes off to the hospital. Shireen and Renee, another flight attendant, were the last two on board. They did everything they could and then left. Then the Pakistani, like, armed forces get onto the plane and, like, charge onto the plane and arrest the hijackers, because now the hijackers have no bullets left, no explosives left.
Right.
They surrender and they arrest them and take them away.
My gosh.
21 people were killed.
Oh, my word. That's...
Nirja did die at the hospital. Of those 21 people, it is really incredible. Again, it's that thing where it's incredible that so few people died in a lot of, but God, like even the people who survived, like what, there's nothing that could ever be more traumatizing than this, right? It's
and like,
so
I just,
horrible.
It's a terrible, awful, no good situation. I just, it's hard for me to imagine it being that long.
17 like, hours.
Oh my
of
God.
A complete stalemate. Of a complete stalemate.
I don't know.
I think about the Air France one that we did. I think this time last year, actually. And that was like days. And they actually did fly to another location and like so dragged out. But like this one is so many people. It's so many people. Almost 400 people just like crushed and then like in complete darkness, just getting shot at and trying to squeeze out of four doors, two of which don't have a slide, and you have to jump down 20 or 30 feet depending on five people were eventually arrested for the hijacking. So some people who were like accomplices who didn't actually participate in the like on the day by you know, so five people were arrested and tried. They were sentenced to death. That sentence was commuted to life in prison. In September 2001, a time that might be familiar to most of you, in September 2001, Safirini was actually sent to, like, handed over to the FBI and brought to the U.S. from Pakistan, where he was serving his sentence. And in the U.S., they actually put him on trial for hijacking this plane in 2001, so 15 years later, which, again, 15 years later, it's a long time, but it's not a long time at all, right?
Yeah, right.
It's not a long time at all. And so he was tried in the U.S. for this hijacking again, September 2001. You know, a lot was going on.
Yeah.
And he was sentenced to 160 years, so life in prison in the U.S.
Yeah.
I want to read this. Not in any way. I hope that all of you will like take me reading this in the way I intended. I'm definitely not trying to like make, I am so radically not trying to make excuses. This was a heinous murder and torture of hundreds of people. Like the torture of hundreds of people, the murder of 21 people. I'm not defending it at all. It just seems like it's part of the story to me. So at the trial, obviously he was found guilty. And the a lot of people, like the family members, survivors, people who were on board this plane, a lot of people traveled to the court to either give their testimony or just to witness it or whatever the case may be. So the people who were present at the trial in the U.S. in 2001, or maybe the trial itself was in 2002, but there were a lot of people who personally experienced this, who had been personally harmed by Safirini. And at the sentencing, when in an American trial, and I imagine in many other countries during sentencing or prior to sentencing, the person found guilty can make a statement. And I'm just going to read the statement. He said, "I am so sorry at what happened. So very, very sorry. I take responsibility for all the pain. My sorrow is from the depth of my heart. If you do not believe I am a person who has a heart, I accept that. I wish I had died on that plane. I sit in my cell. I have no hope, no feeling. I know I will die by myself and I will never see my family again. When I did this, I believed I was helping the Palestinian people's dream of a homeland. Now I believe that the organization, the ABO, this was not their aim. I know now I was used and so were the others. I was wrong. I was at fault. I was wrong. And the victims who fell were innocent people. I was brainwashed.
Damn.
Yeah. And again, I'm not in any way saying I don't, please, everybody, receive that. Give me the benefit of the doubt when I read that. Like, because I'm not saying that to be like.
No, no, no.
It just seems like it's part of the story. It just is part of the story. It is part of the story.
It is.
It is part of the story.
I mean, there's a reason that people are allowed to say something, you know?
Right. Right. And again, I don't know. I'm sure to the hundreds of people who were directly affected by this, who were there or who read that afterwards or who heard it afterwards, like, I'm sure that it meant totally different things to all of them. Right. Yeah. I'm sure some of them, like, it was very meaningful. I'm sure to some of them, it's just like, well, fuck you. I don't care. Like, fuck you. Good. Like, bye forever. And it's not like, it just seems like it's part of the story. And so I wanted to read it because it is, man, it's bad to fall into, like, under the influence of people who want to use you to do very bad things.
Yeah.
And it's bad to want to do bad things, right? Like, I don't know.
Right, like, it doesn't excuse, I mean, just like you're saying, like, it doesn't excuse anything, of course. You know, there were, and, like, it doesn't matter if it's true or not. Like, he's essentially been sentenced to death, just death by jail, like, lifetime in jail, you know?
Right, right.
I know that that means a lot of different things for a lot of different people.
Right.
It's just, like, for me, a life sentence in jail is death, you know?
Right.
I would,
And, I mean, often, it's a complex thing. It's a complex thing. And certainly, like, certainly, I mean, the people who died, I mean, again, like, the, not just Nirja, like, and not just Rajesh, and not just Mahirji, like, all of these different, you know, the people who I named, but also the other people who died, and also, like, I don't know, how could you, there's something, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down is a book, I don't know if you read it yet, but it's a book about, like, a lot of different things, but it's about it's about, like, a refugee, like, a Hmong family in the 80s getting medical care for their youngest daughter's seizure disorder and the way that, like, culture interprets that differently and how that affects medical care. But it is also about, like, refugees and everything they go through, and it's a really good book. But the there's, like, a quote in it that is so haunting to me because it's a husband and father who had fled with his family, and the man, like, this is years later, right? But he's saying, like, you can never, like, you can never tell your wife I would do anything for you again because she knows exactly what you would or wouldn't do. Like, you survived, you got here, but whatever happened, he didn't go into any detail, but, like, she knows what you would do when push comes to shove, and she knows what you won't do. And I guess I say that because, like, it's impossible to know who, like, who escaped that plane and in their complete panic, like, pushed another person or something. And I'm not, I'm in no way demonizing them, right? You're, like, just in the most heinous panic, like, you're not in control of yourself in any kind of normal way, right? You are just trying to not die, right? While you're being shot at in a pitch black tuna can, like, and, like, but like how that affects your self-concept and how that like can harm you so much, even if you are like unbruised, like even if you have no physical pain, and even if you can deal with other parts of the trauma, just things like it's just horrible. Yeah. So like I don't in any way want to make excuses for Safirini at all. Like,
no.
But I just want, it's part of the story.
So. Yeah, for sure.
Mm.
Wow. That's terrible. I have to like, the entire time you were telling this story, I had to keep pulling myself back from saying certain things because I have to remember that it's in the 1980s. Like, it was just different, you know? Policy was different, things were different, experience was different, like, you know, there's, like, a lot of context and political context, like you said, to the story, obviously, that is, like, I don't know. Because my instinct is to be, like, there's no reason that they were on the ground for 17 hours. You know what I mean? Like, surely there could have been a different way to get people out of the plane or de-escalate the situation or, you know. And I also understand that's, like, a very American thought. You know, like, I recognize that as well. It's unfathomable to me. Like, sitting there for so long, I just can't even. Right. And then to have it end in such a chaotic way, like, because your body just has to be out of adrenaline at that point, you know?
Oh, it's like the exhaustion. Just the total, like, psychological and physical exhaustion.
Right. And on top of all the psychological stuff, it is the 80s. Like, we're not really talking about that stuff yet, you know? Obviously, but not in the same way. Right.
Right. And I think that that's another thing is that, like, so many hijackings prior to 9/11 ended with, like, few or no casualties. And that is, like, another piece of context, right? Like, there were dozens, if not hundreds, of plane hijackings prior to 9/11. And they were, most of them ended without any death.
Yeah.
And so but this one, before they even got on the plane, they killed two people.
Right.
So that's like, you can't even, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. So much to.
Well, and I mean, even like technology was so different too. Like, you know, the resources that they had available.
Right.
Like, cause it's even in the beginning of the story when he's like, when they're like shouting out to the workers on the ground, like it reminds me of an SNL skit of like,
right,
you know, these hijackers have hijacked the plane and they're just shouting out of the plane, you know, and people on the ground are like, what, like, you know, just
right it seems like,
yeah,
absurd. It's absurd.
Exactly.
Oh yeah.
And to have it just end so chaotically, it just,
oh my god,
it really fucks somebody up, you know?
Yeah,
because it's like more sinister than a plane crash, you know?
Oh, way more,
like, way more sinister.
Yeah,
sinister. Like, it's just, yeah,
right. There's a Indian movie called Nirja, came out in 2016, about this. So Nirja, I'll say it like this. So in an event like this, people are going to recall things differently. I like did my best to like synthesize the information and like tell it cohesively, combining different people's accounts, right? Mm. So, but there are places where there's things that conflict, right? There just are things that conflict. But like, for example, there is a passenger who said that she saw Nirja, like she saw the hijackers like grab her by the hair and shoot her point blank. But Nirja was alive when they when her colleagues pulled her off the plane and it was pitch black. So it's like, it's not a sin to misinterpret what you saw or just think that you saw like a different person, because they certainly could have done that to a different passenger or, you know what I mean? So I, that's just an example of like, people are just going to recall things differently. That's so, but the, but Nirja like handled this situation with unfathomable bravery, right? And she was the highest ranking person on that plane, which is crazy. It's just crazy to, a few months after you become a flight attendant, be the die as the highest ranking person on board this plane. Some people did, like you, we, you alluded to it earlier, but some people did react to like the idea that the pilots ran very negatively, especially after things went so wrong. But like Pan Am and all of the flight attendants like 100% had their back. They were like, no, that was the best. That's, we don't even, we'll never know how many people's lives that saved.
Right. I was just going to say it would be a different, it would still be on this podcast, just in a different way.
Right. Exactly.
You know, the story would just be different.
Right. Right. And it would have, I mean, it's just, maybe it saved 400 people's lives. Maybe it just saved 3 lives. Maybe it only saved the pilot's lives, but that's still, their lives matter. Like, they're people. Right. Something that is unbelievably incredible to me is that most of the flight attendants continued to work for Pan Am as flight attendants.
Oh my God.
Insane.
But never.
Insane. I mean, amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
Nirja received like the, she was like particularly like, she was honored in like many different countries, many different ways. Her face was on a stamp in India. Like she, and if you think about like, she was so remarkable in her bravery and did die. Like, she lost her life. She could have been off that plane.
Yeah.
She could have been the first one off the plane. Yeah. Right. And, and she died because she was trying to save other people, children even. And so, and she was like a domestic violence survivor in the 80s in India. You know what I mean? And domestic, I mean, domestic violence is like her story of like, of leaving and of her parents like total complete support for getting out of that situation was like deeply meaningful and like a very important story in like the context of her time and place, and still is. I don't want to diminish the way that she continues to be important, but, and she's like a beautiful model, so there's like hundreds of pictures of her, and so I'm sure they are on the Instagram as you're listening to this, but
wow.
A lot. Story is a lot.
Wow.
Very
incredible.
Remarkable. The movie is meant to be excellent. So I haven't watched it, but I recommend checking it out.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you don't like, there's, I can't imagine what they would have to change. I mean, like,
it's
from the magazine to the, like, you know, the everything, the whole story.
Yeah. So much, right? This, so much.
Yeah. So many attempts to like improve the situation.
And I think that the movie, I didn't, I, like I said, I didn't watch it, but like I saw clips of it and like read about it and stuff like that. And besides being like very, very popular, very like well-received movie, her mother, I believe, was like involved in making it. Like, she was like consulted on it. And the story, the movie rather, does follow the her parents' experience quite a bit. And that's, I think, I mean, I didn't get to go into that at all, but during this 17-hour time frame, people with loved ones on that plane around the world are like desperately waiting to hear about their family member and like going through all of that too. And I think that that's a, like an aspect that I didn't even get into, but would be, is again, part of the story. So.
Gosh. Wow.
Yeah. A lot. But what is it? 357 people survived.
Yeah.
Which is
amazing.
Amazing.
I mean, it is really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Great
job.
That
is Pan Am 73.
Yeah. Thanks for telling that.
Thank you for listening. Yeah. Do you have a oh, the plane survived, I feel like I should say.
Yeah.
The plane. I like looked. I mean, the plane of it. Right. They patched up the plane. I looked to try to find out how long the plane was in the air for, and I didn't hunt it down, but I did find the like FAA like report that says like status repaired, and I was like, okay. The Empress of the Seas.
Maybe it's still flying. On.
Maybe. I hope so.
It'd be great.
You go a little plane.
Yeah. Gosh.
You have a Empress of the Seas fact?
I do, actually. Our fact comes from Jeff today.
Jeff.
Sweet Jeff sent us a little bit of an update on the SR-71 that we talked about last week.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what Jeff says. He said a couple of amazing things to add about the SR-71. The airframe expanded by nearly a foot while flying supersonically because of the heat.
Oh my
so it would just, it would grow by a foot.
Oh my gosh.
The
like
fuselage.
Those little like dinosaur tabs that you put into the
in water and leave.
Yeah. Yeah.
It gets bigger. Exactly.
Oh my God.
The fuselage panels were designed to fit loosely to accommodate the expansion. The gas tank also leaked fuel when not in flight because of the looseness needed.
Oh
so it's
my
just
gosh.
Like leaking fuel. And the exterior windshield was made of quartz because, to deal with the incredible temperatures. Imagine. I mean,
the windshield
it's going to happen, like, it is going to happen that that does become a natural way to fly, like, you know, not in our lifetime probably, but.
I mean,
just feel there has to be.
We gotta do the Concorde story. We gotta do it so we can talk about supersonic planes more.
Yeah.
But the quartz windshield.
Interested. Yeah, that's
the
crazy.
The quartz windshield. I cannot. United is making a supersonic plane, they say.
Yeah.
That they're gonna, or they're not making it, obviously. They ordered supersonic planes. So we're gonna find out if. We're gonna find out.
That is.
The quartz windshield, I'm sorry. I'm like, the leaky fuel tank is like, that is like the primo comedy that I come to aviation for. But like that the high tech plane has like a leaky fuel
leaky
tank
fuel
by
tank.
Design. Like, but the quartz windshield.
Yeah.
It goes faster than the speed of sound. And it has like what I assume is like a glittering rock windshield that
exactly.
is so amazing to me.
It's just like purpley glitter.
Yeah, that's what I'm imagining. Is just the beautiful. Did you like collect rocks when you were a kid? I assume all kids do this, right? This is a universal thing.
No, my brother collects sticks.
Oh, sticks.
Yeah, a stick collection outside of the house. You just gather.
What makes
sticks.
A good stick?
Who knows?
Which
who
brother?
Knows? Tyler.
Tyler, my brother. You're listening to this.
Yeah.
What makes a good stick? I want to know. Tell me. I do. I do want to know.
Sticks,
so,
you know,
but surely, at the like lake or whatever, if you went like and there's rocks, would you pick rocks up?
I personally wouldn't know, but people in like I knew people who did. I did not.
Yeah.
I skipped rocks a lot.
Oh, I never learned to do that. See, so
okay,
I had to hold on to the rocks.
I didn't.
So
yeah,
I did
not keep the rock. I skipped it.
Oh yeah, I got in trouble at like many a state park because they're like you actually cannot. Take the rocks. They belong to the state. They are wars of the state. But and the Grand Canyon. But Brian, like every time I've gone to the Grand Canyon, I've been like, I want to take a rock. And there's signs everywhere telling you
do not take the
you
rock.
Can't right. They're America's rocks. They're not for you.
Right.
And So I have to put them back.
Yeah.
There's actually, gosh, where was it? By the Grand Canyon, someone who lives out west or just knows the area, tell me if you know what I'm talking about. But there's a park site, not at the Grand Canyon, but not far from it, that has like a lots of cool rocks that you would really want to take if you were so inclined, which I assumed everyone had the urge to steal rocks, but apparently not, Mariah. But
this is the buying the car. We should tell everybody about this so that everyone knows, just in case.
We should, but I hold on, wait a second.
Yes, yeah, one update at a time.
What? So, but at this site, at the park, right? Like there's like display. Yeah. With handwritten letters and typed letters and rocks. So each like letter has like a rock. And it's people who like throughout history have stolen rocks from the park and gotten home and felt guilty mailed the rocks back. And like, so there are all these like apology letters like typed out or handwritten just being like, I'm so sorry. And one of them is from like a child and it's like, you know, like a fifth, not a fifth grader, probably like a third grader. So it's like that like sloppy handwriting. It's just like, I'm sorry I took the rock. Please forgive me. Like love Tommy or whatever.
Yeah.
Like
just,
and that, I just.
It's beautiful. It's double whammy. They got the signs and they're like, you're going to feel guilty about this. So just don't. Just skip that part.
Right.
Skip but just the fee.
Skip the fee. Just
shipping it back.
Guys, listen. I don't know. I'm not the only person. I'm positive I'm not the only person who has the deep desire to pick up and keep rocks. So especially as a kid.
I mean, like I have a rock from one of the volcanoes from Costa Rica.
Are you allowed to steal them?
I don't know.
Is that like forbidden?
I don't know. I took it like in like 2012.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And I don't. Well, I mean,
how long do rocks even last? 2012. Right. But yeah, like what were they expecting? No, but like a pumice, like a volcanic rock or whatever.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And I keep it in all my backpacks. Goes with me. It's just like I get it. I get it.
Yeah.
But it's
all that just like gravel from people's like driveways that has like its quartz or whatever, so it's like sparkly.
Yeah
When people have like the really pretty like white gravel driveways
and
it's all that white gravel.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
give me your driveway. Yeah. I love these beautiful rocks.
Yeah,
I will take all of these. Like
there used to be those kinds of rocks in my grandparents' garden. And my grandpa would dig up the garden bed so that the rocks would be there and then like cover them a little bit so that when I came over, I could go in the back and dig them up myself.
Oh,
and I remember, it was like digging for gold. It was great. It was so nice.
Yeah.
But they're cool. You like wash them off. Rock. They're so pretty. Yeah.
Right. They're beautiful. They're so beautiful. Yeah. It's just a good time. But I never did. I never learned how to skip rocks. I had not successfully skipped a rock.
It's a good time, too.
Yeah. It looks great.
Yeah.
It stresses me out, though, because one time somebody said, if you skip a rock, you are like, it is entirely possible that you are the first and last human who will ever touch that rock.
Yes.
Whoa. That's too much responsibility.
Yeah.
No. Put the rock. I don't know. Feels
just
like
think about how many rocks are there that it was the last person that will ever touch it.
But probably not like Ontario because it's going to dry up. But that.
Yeah.
It's another thing. So altogether.
Right. That's probably more actually what is going to happen.
That makes me feel worse. It doesn't make me feel better.
Right.
It makes me feel better for the rock. But yeah. I don't know, guys. It's 10 o'clock.
And, it is.
Yeah. It's been. It's not a bad day. It's a good day.
It's a good day. Yeah. It's just been really busy. I'm sure everyone else is so busy too.
Right.
It's just, I don't know. Life feels like it's kicking back up again. Not that it hasn't, obviously, but it just, I don't know.
Yeah. No,
everyone's just
totally kind of
like nonstop going again. And
yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. Trying to keep up.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot to keep up with. I will say that since we moved back, I like went to the doctor, which is very good. And I bring that up. Great. There's no medical problem, but I bring that up because I was talking to somebody and they were not aware of like the FQHC.
Yeah.
So federally qualified community health centers.
FQHC.
FQHC, yep. Federally qualified health center.
Yep.
Yep. Okay, so US, community health center
yeah.
is just what they're called, but FQHC
yes.
is the designation.
Yes.
Okay, it's you will explain what it is better than I will.
It's a federally qualified health center. So if you're in the U.S., you don't have insurance or you need help applying for insurance, you can go online.
Or you don't want insurance. I'm just
or you don't want insurance,
there.
Yeah.
You don't want it, like, if you're forgoing insurance. Well, yeah. I mean, everybody wants it, but if you're doing the math and making the decision to not get it.
Yes,
you
exactly.
are also eligible.
Exactly. And the government, United States government, gives qualified health centers who go through a strenuous application process and have to, you know, like it's a very thorough, like application process, I guess, is what I want to say.
It's a huge headache. Yeah. It's a lot to go through.
It is.
And they have to have like so many providers who like offer specific services.
Yeah.
And like, yeah.
And they offer healthcare basically to people who don't have insurance. You can also have insurance and go there. Like when I was in Buffalo, I worked for a health center, qualified health center, and they were my doctor. But yeah, yeah. If you don't have enough money for insurance or you don't have enough money for a doctor, they will. They cannot turn you away based on income. They will probably do like an income-based plan or a sliding scale fee.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, definitely life-saving stuff. Also, they have like tons of community resources. So if you need, you know, therapy or social work or food referrals, it's a really good place. It's kind of like a lot of health centers are kind of a one-stop shop for a lot of services. So, you know,
yeah,
they're great. I can't. Yeah, they're amazing. And I can't speak highly to enough of them.
Yeah. I think that it's so. My understanding is that they have to have like us, like psychiatrist or like a psych prescriber, a gynecologist, a pediatrician and a primary care doctor, or that's usually what they'll have at least. And then they'll have like providers and prescribers who are not doctors, like NPs and PAs, so
yeah.
stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I think most, if not all of them, right, were already community health centers prior to this system, and then raised the bar or whatever so that they met these requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that a lot of times they are. Many of them were like kind of originally designed to like serve like this community or that community, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
like the one that you worked at was like designed to help refugees, but obviously now serves everybody, right? So if you are a refugee, it's a great place to go because like when I called them when we moved here. That's not the one we ended up going to, but when I called them, the language choices were English, Spanish, or Burmese, and I was like, oh yeah, perfect, right?
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
So and then you know the one that I went to in New York City was Charles B.
Chinese,
Wang. Great.
Yeah, it's a Chinese run and like
It was
every time we went in there,
I was
always the only white person in there.
Yeah,
and
but it was
and it was wonderful, like so good.
Yeah, superb care, but it's kind of that like. If you are part of like the community it was originally intended to serve, awesome, because your needs are going to be met even better than they might be at another place.
Yeah.
But if you're not part of the community it was originally designed to serve, you're still great. Like, awesome. You get
exactly
great healthcare, right? That's affordable.
Yeah.
And
honestly,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, and honestly, in those situations, a lot of times you'll probably not better care. That's not what I'm trying to say, but like people will be interested in you a little bit more because that changes their demographics for reporting and stuff.
That is exactly what my dear friend who worked at Charles B. Wang before.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I don't have a doctor. And he was like, please come to
Charles
B. Wang because like we need, like, it'll help our demographics. And yeah, I was just like, yeah, yeah. I mean, deal, right. deal. Right. I'll pay $15 to see the doctor. And like, yeah, deal.
Yeah. yeah.
So if you don't have insurance for whatever reason, yeah. or you have insurance, that's a huge headache because nobody accepts it. Right. Like the yep. community health plans and things like that. They don't take, they take, like, you know, Medicaid and all of those that can be hard to use. So
yeah,
that's just the little PSA, because I was having a, you know, conversation with somebody who wasn't aware of that. And
yeah,
and if you live in any other country, don't worry about it. You're fine.
yeah, right.
you know, but but yeah, that's a, I guess, enough politics for one episode. So. but no,
I know we're both sleepy. It's a slippery slope.
We're too sleepy to talk about it. We really are. I left the 9/11 stuff in that one podcast, and I feel like I've been leaving more of these things in. But one of these days, we're gonna go too far.
Right. Right.
Yeah. That's what the editing process is for. Because sometimes I'm like, I don't even think that. Like, why did I say that? You know?
Right.
Or like, ah.
Yeah, I think about that all the time. And I'm just like, I am always nervous that I sound dumb as shit. I'm going to say two.
People need to know that you are not dumb.
Oh, right, but. Right. Like, it's that, like, initial reaction of, like, oh, man, a lot of people are going to listen to this. I have no idea what I said. Sound stupid, but well, that's out there now, you know.
But like, here it is.
Yep, yeah, I cared for 1 second and now it's over.
No, that's there is not a single time that I have every single time I publish an episode, I think this is the week that I'm gonna get 45 emails being like, do you even know what a plane is? Like, have you ever heard of planes, Casey? Like, you know nothing. Like, I just think every week, like, this is going to be the week. Everyone's going to be like, actually, you were 100% wrong, right. which is totally possible. It's probably going to happen at some point.
Yeah.
I have never seen a plane and I don't know what they are. So, like, it's going to happen. People will find out at some point. But
we all need to manage our expectations here.
Oh, yeah. Please. All of
across
us.
Across the board.
Right. You and I need to be gentler with ourselves and the people of the world who already have shown us so much grace. Just need to keep on being amazing and gracious.
Yeah,
so.
You guys are doing great.
You guys are killing it. We love you. We love you. We love you.
We do.
I love you, Mariah.
I love you too, Casey.
I love you so much.
Yes.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Yep. Oh, have a great Thanksgiving.
Oh, the best. Eat squash if that's what you like.
Ooh, squash is so good.
It's my favorite.
I'll go make some sweet potato pie.
Ooh. Oh my gosh. Right now?
Yeah.
Right now. I'm going to go to Wegmans. Okay.
Yes. Okay.
One, two, three. Deal. Break. Love you.
Love you. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of The Pod Crashed. We so hope you enjoyed it. We love you guys. If you want to get in touch with us for any reason, you can find us on Instagram or TikTok, or you can email us at thepodcrashed@gmail.com. We hope that you're having just a wonderful, wonderful, early winter season. We hope that you had a great Thanksgiving, if that's a holiday you celebrate. And, thanks for coming along for this crazy ride with us. So we'll see you next week.